Thank you. So first of all, thanks a lot for again this invitation for the whole program. It was very interesting and interacting with people and following the different things that usually are not exactly in my field. So it's interesting always, you know, contamination and listen to other stories from different point of view. So I'm going to talk about light dark matter jet accelerators today. So it's quite different from the usual topics of DART. And I don't have an introduction to justify what we are looking for, the possibility of new portals that mainly include particles weakly interacting with the light mediators that may be light or heavy, lighter or heavier than, let's say, standard model particles that provide the two options, the decay or invisible decay for a mediator. The region where we are interested in and where we think that the accelerator may provide an insight and better understanding and more information than the direct detection that so far has some limitation is mainly the region between, let's say, MeV up to, let's say, few GeV. This is the region where we are concentrated. So it is the mass of the mediator, the dark matter, generally speaking. And in this case, the search using accelerator can be done only because nowadays we have a very high intense beam. That, let's say, the energy, since the energy we are talking about, the mass of the particles, is not very high, we can limit ourselves to, let's say, low or medium energy, let's say GeV-ish or tens of GeV beams. Experiments are already running, so I'm not talking about, you know, science fiction. This is already Miniboon, already took data, already placed limits. NA64 at CERN already took data and published. Other experiments like PADMI, for instance, in Frascati, or BDX, hopefully will happen in the future at the Jefferson Lab, are just on the paper, but there is a lot of activity on that, so I think it's interesting to review it. The advantage of searching for dark matter accelerator is that obviously there is a way to distinguish, or let's say that with the direct detection, if you observe a signal, it's very difficult to correlate with any other possibilities that you may have from, you know, cosmic anomalies, whatever it is. The dark matter accelerator, you always have the capability of switch off your beam. As far as you are able to control the background that may come from the beam itself. But, you know, the standard model particles are known. We have particles that interact with matter, other particles that interact less, like neutrinos, that may provide a background for your experiment, but they are reasonably known. So anything that you will observe switching on and off your accelerator will tell you that there is something new. How then you can correlate this dark matter, I mean, this new signal, this new particle with the dark matter is another story. Obviously, there is a big jump from here to there. But still, I mean, if you have, you know, discovery of a new interaction of the new particle that survive out of any prediction of the standard model, will be any case a big breakthrough. So again, this is the first advantage, as you can switch on and off the accelerator. And then, as I said, they have a specific sensitivity in the region where direct detection so far, because I have to say that there is a lot of activity in direct detection search to extend the sensitivity. Usually the experiments are designed to look at the recoil of nuclei. Then you can do better if you look at, for instance, recoil of electrons that are lighter particles. So in principle, they can be sensitive to lower to smaller mass dark matter. So there is a lot of efforts on that. But on the other hand, it's also very difficult because technically you are looking at signals that are at a level of a single electron scattering inside the material. So it's tricky. I mean, it's not trivial. So best limits provided so far by the standard, let's say, like Xenon collaboration, RELAX, standard direct detection experiment that look as a fraction of the data with very low threshold that allow to do this kind of analysis within their data set, show that the sensitivity can be extended, let's say, in this range, while if you look at the sensitivity that you can reach now with the accelerator, I mean, without, you know, any big infrastructure or new machine built, but just using what it is, you gain at least a couple of order of magnitude. So it seems that at least, you know, another good reason to explore it. One thing that I have to mention is that the most part of the experiments and also the results that are produced, let's say limits mainly because there were no observations so far, comes from old experiments that were reinterpreted in terms of the A prime or dark photon decay, or I mean scalar decay. I mean all the zoology of the dark matter mediator you may imagine. But the important thing is that these experiments were done for other purposes. Many of them were very old, so it's also very difficult now to know all the details in terms of the experimental part to be sure that your limits that you are. I will show you a couple of examples for that. So the framework we are working in is quite simple. We have the standard model on one side, you have the dark sector on the other, and they communicate via a mediator that we call it A prime. I mean, obviously, then you can be more specific about the chi r is the dark matter particles, maybe fermionic, maybe scalars. Let's say now very generically that you have these two sectors connected in some way by a mediator. On the other hand, you have the A prime that communicate with the standard model. So at the end of the day, you have a four parameters model. And then there are two options, mainly due to the kinematics, depending on the mass of the chi, if you want, and then the relative mass of the A prime electrons, or that is the lighter particle in the standard model, or the chi, that tells you that A prime may decay in plasi minus, obviously, and other particles that are more heavier than that, like muons or pions. But let's say, again, for simplicity, that E plasi minus are the lighter ones. So how, in this case, you have to have, first of all, you have to produce the A prime, and producing the A prime is costing an epsilon square, epsilon multiplied the charge, so it goes like the square of the epsilon, and then the A prime needs to interact with your world, if you want to see something at the end in the visible decay. That means that you have to pay an extra epsilon square, since the resonance has the width that is proportional to the coupling. In case of the invisible decay, assuming that the dark matter is lighter than the mediator, then in principle you can, again, you radiate the A prime, and then it couples mainly to the dark matter. That on one side is negative, because you don't have particles to detect, I mean, no standard model particle easy to detect. On the other hand, the advantage is that in principle this process is not supposed to be suppressed, because the coupling between the mediator to the dark sector, I mean, there is no reason why a priori they should be small or tiny, while we know that for sure that the coupling between the A prime or the dark photon to the standard model particle should be small. In terms of accelerator, there are mainly two techniques. One is about a fixed target, the other is using colliders. I'm just focusing on the plasi minus, but it works obviously also for hadron colliders too. The process in this case that people mainly consider is the so-called A prime stralum. We'll come back later on that, where you have the A prime radiated by an heavy nucleus, and you produce an A prime. Obviously, in this case, you have mainly the annihilation of E plasi minus that produce a gamma plus. Usually, the standard process is two gammas. In one gamma is replaced by an A prime, and then the A prime decays to lepton pairs, muons or E plasi minus. Obviously, muons are much easier than to detect in a collider environment. If we compare luminosity, obviously fixed target is mean, because you have the density, the atoms in the material, that compared to the beam, that obviously is a limited number of particles inside. On the other hand, if you look at the cross section, I mean, how these two processes scale, this goes as one of the mass to the second power. So it means that as soon as the mass of the mediator gets a little bit higher, you immediately get this 1 over m square limit that is very difficult to overcome. On the other hand, for the colliders, they scale as the energy to the square of the incoming beams. So it means that there is no such strong correlation with the mass of the mediator. So it means that usually this is the reason why Babar or Bell or the other colliders provide and extend the limits in the parameter space. I will show you again. It is obviously in an environment that is cleaner in some sense, is a low background, because you know exactly what you are doing, you master pretty well E plus E minus interactions, while for obviously a fixed target is more tricky, because you produce a lot of mass together with, in principle, the A prime. But again, there are advantages and disadvantages in the two techniques. This is the situation for this, let's say, particle search in the visible decay before in the range of 2008. And this is the after that there was a lot of activities in many different machine, or mainly, I mean, all labs in the world having a machine, or also reusing data collected a long time ago by other machine. Look at the possibility of reinterpret new results of experiment, or running new experiment, brand new experiment targeted to look for the 8 prime. So mainly every kind of, with all possible techniques that you can imagine, electron beam, proton beams, or decay of mesons, and so on. And this is the situation today that cover pretty well. I mean, it is already covered by the solid colors, and also there are a bunch of experiments running in the next few years, like ATX or HPS or SHIP even in the future, that will cover, that will try to cover and fully close the parameter space if no observation will be reported. For the invisible decay, it is more tricky because the experiment really require or that you detect the dark matter after that interacts, or it requires that you know exactly what you are, some way you have to hermetically measure everything but the dark matter, so it's much more tricky to be done. So in that sense, the parameter space is much more unconstrained with respect to the visible decay, where you just the fact that you don't measure anything immediately tells you that you are not producing the particle. So if we look at the list of machines available, this is from a couple of 2 years ago, SLAC, it was a kind of survey of how the situation was, and you can see here that the planned experiment for the future are mainly using electron beam. They may use also colliders, and there are bunches of proton beams running or that will run in the near future. And there is also a short list of machine using positron. Actually, the number of positron beam in the world is gets smaller and smaller after that that Cornell and Babar, mainly the and SLAC, have no any more the particle physics related to their programs. Babar, Bell remain the only big colliders for the future in the plus and minus in that range. I mean, 10 GeV range. But still, there are some of them that may be used for that. So if we go now more in details on the mechanism to produce an 8 prime from a lepton beam, in particular from E plus and E minus, this is exactly the same, the same mechanism, at least at first order. This is the radiation of the 8 prime, so-called 8 prime strahlung, is very similar to the Brehm strahlung. I mean, it's more or less the same idea, that you produce your electron that hit a heavy nucleus that contains a lot of, I mean, the strong field, and the strong field has photons that are mainly transverse photons, so mainly, let's say, kind of electron gamma scattering from real photons. And so you can, treat it as you do with the Brehm strahlung, including a form factor for the nucleus. There are many assumptions, many approximations that people usually do when calculate. And this is a very important ingredient because all limits are based on the approximation that you do and the way how you calculate this diagram. This 90% of limits shown on the papers are based on that. And there were some criticism. Obviously, you want to do better. And I will show you at the end that there are some tiny effect if you consider in a better way the treatment of these in a proper way. The approximation that usually are very crude and very that may be useful, may be good for the past, the first side to the experiment. But now that there is a lot of activity, you want to do things in a more proper way to be sure that you get the limits and in a more correct at least. So this is the main mechanism that everybody use mainly. Obviously, if you have a positron, the other option is that you have annihilation. And annihilation may mainly goes through these two diagrams that we already see as a way to look for the A prime. So it's a non-resonant annihilation or resonance when really E plus E minus stay together to provide the A prime. Obviously, this mechanism here, the resonant annihilation, requires that E plus E minus has exactly the energy to create the A prime. So the cross-section is proportional to the width of the A prime. So I mean, a priori you can say, okay, this is a tiny contribution, because usually, I mean, what's the chance that you really have a positron with the right energy? I will show you in a while that there is a condition, a particular condition, where a positron may have many positrons may go through the exact energy that excite the resonance. Another thing that you may want to notice is the dependence on alpha. So this diagram here is mainly a factor of 1,000 stronger than the Strahlung. So this is another important point that, okay, again, the number of, you know, of positrons, if as far as you have a reasonable number of positrons that may resonate, then this is for sure the mechanism that in certain condition will be will provide the highest cross section, so the higher probability to produce it. Obviously, each of these diagrams has a different angular distribution of the decay product or the A prime, and so this is again another non-trivial point that you want to consider, because then the A prime needs to fly and in some sense at some point need to interact with your detector, so you have to fold in the acceptance of the detector, so you want to know where the A prime are produced. You can't just do, as people mainly did in the past, a single approximation where the A prime is getting the whole energy of incoming electron, and that's it. You obviously have an angular spread that you want to consider to provide reliable results on your estimate. So this resonant and non-resonant annihilation has been exploited, as I told you, by colliders, and many results, for instance, the visible search, were based on that. So you have a collider, a plus and minus may hit each other, you produce a gamma and an A prime. The pairs of leptons, usually muons, that are easy to detect, are used to build an invariant mass, and then you can, or just trigger the event, and then you look at the missing mass of the gamma, I mean, depending if you are measuring the full exclusive process or not. This is based on, so the limits are reported by Babar, for instance, or Cloy, that is a plus and minus collider at 1 GeV, while Babar was much higher energy. And Bell for the future is projecting results. So this technique, let's say, is well established, and people, you know it and provide a significant exclusion in the parameter space. There is also some results reported by Babar in the invisible sector. So in this case, you just get gamma plus A prime, but you don't measure the A prime. That is much more tricky. Again, it seems to be, you know, trivial. You say, okay, if you can measure gamma plus mu minus, why can't you measure just gamma plus something missing? The problem is that in a collider, you can imagine how many gammas you have. So it's very difficult to implement a trigger the reaction has only one gamma in the final state, nothing else. So you need to have a trigger that triggers on a single gamma. And this is monophoton trigger, obviously, is critical. This show that the data collected in Babar with this monophoton trigger is about 10% of the full statistics. So at the end of the day, you don't have enough, you know, number of statistics to analyze in a proper way. And also, it will be very challenging for Bell for the future, because it's not clear if, again, they can cope with the high rate due to these monophotons that may be produced by, you know, you can imagine whatever thing. Electromagnetic process will produce a photon at some point in a collider, so you can imagine how difficult it is just to select an event that has only a single photon. So difficulties, but still very, very valuable results obtained by Babar in the invisible sector. There are other ideas to use on a thin target. This is more projected for the future. Say, why, if we want to exploit this annihilation, you can use the plus and minus, or as I told you before, you may shoot a positron beam over a thin target. In this case, you may have annihilation of the positron over the electron in the material, and you apply the same trick. In this case, you have a kind of fixed target arrangement, so your A prime will or your photon, both of them, you know, will go mainly forward, because you transfer the energy of the incoming positron to the final state. And so the idea is that if I will be able to measure very precisely these photons, then I can do the missing mass analysis and try to see if I have a bump in it and try to spot. So it's a very, very clean, because again, as far as you are able to run this experiment, measuring the gamma will provide, it's not, I mean, this is really a peak over, you know, a smooth background that you are expecting. So it's a very precise information that you have a resonance. Not only on that, but you can also get the energy and the mass of the particle. So you don't need to do any assumption how the A prime decays. I mean, it's just you just rely on this process. Okay, this is a very basic process. You know, annihilation should work if this construction of coupling the A prime to get to the electromagnetic current is correct. So it's very basic. Again, experimentally, this is tricky because you measure. You want to measure a photon, but obviously, when you shoot a positron beam over even on a thin target, you produce a lot of junk. In particular, you have a regular Bernsteinium that produces a single photon, and this single photon is going to go again usually in the acceptance of your detector. So you have to get rid of Bernsteinium. You have to get rid of multiple gammas production, 2-3 gammas. Some of them are constrained by kinematics. Some other are less. So I mean, again, it's not an easy job, but people. Investigated, in particular at Cornell and Novosibirsk. Here are the parameters of the machine. Both VEP and Frascati has a beam in a range of 500 MeV, while Cornell had in the past 5 GeV, so it's much higher. One thing that here are reported, you know, the exclusion plot. Obviously, they are quite peaked in the region where you have the acceptance, where you have the resonance is peaking. Since I told you that there is a kind of one-to-one correlation between the energy of the beam and the mass of the resonance, it is for the kinematics of the annihilation. They are strongly tight. There was also a proposal to run this experiment in the future if a new facility with positron beam will be available. There is a discussion. It is under discussion, but hopefully it will happen in the next future. With positron higher energy. The advantage of using a fixed target experiment with higher positron energy is that the mass goes like the maximum mass you can produce goes like the square root of the energy of the beam. So this is really, you know, in some sense limiting. You see that the maximum energy in the case of 1 GeV is 30 MeV. In case of 10 GeV is 100 MeV. That allows you to explore, you know, a wider parameter range. And again, you have sensitivity in the region of the resonance, and then you have some sensitivity here in the region of non-resonant annihilation. And again, problem of background has not to be under-evaluated. I mean, it's a tricky part. Also, your calorimeter needs to be very good because you have to have a good resolution to pin down the peak of the smooth background. For beam dump experiments, the trick is a little bit different. So the approach is that you shoot an electron, or in the case of a positron beam, over a thick target now. So the particle, again, radiate photons, and together photons, you may imagine that they radiate also E prime. The E prime needs to travel, needs to survive to the target, and then goes in a so-called decay volume where you have your detector, and then you can measure something. Now, if you look at the different parameters, the phase space that you can access with this kind of experiment usually extend quite well in epsilon, because it is related to the thickness of your shielding. That means that the particle to cross the shielding needs to have a very weak coupling to the standard model. So you are effectively looking at the epsilon small. So it means that you have sensitivity in this range. At some point, is epsilon is so small that you don't produce any more the A prime, and then you are limited. On the other hand, here you may have that the particle may decay inside the shield. So decay inside the shield, you don't see the production of the decay, and then you are limited to if it is too coupled to the world, to the standard model, you don't have sensitivity. So it's a tricky, it's a balance between the size of your decay volume, the size of the shield, and the energy of initial beam that tells you what is the sensitivity that you can actually reach. And we'll see that is quite significant in an extended region. The technique here is very simple. I mean, you shoot an electron beam, you have some shielding, and you look what happens after that, okay? If you see a particle, a pairs of plus and minus produced. The other possibility is looking at invisible decay that is obviously more demanding in terms of intensity of the beam. In this case, you smash again an electron beam on a dump, but the idea is that the particle, your mediator decays, but the particles that are produced, in particular dark matter particle, may travel downstream of a shield that you put in front of your detector and re-interact with your detector. Obviously, you have to pay a big price here, because not only you pay an epsilon squared to produce the particle, but you pay another epsilon squared to detect the dark matter that needs to recouple to the A prime with mechanism like that. I mean, similar, in the same way how you produce, you also look at the interaction with the electron of your detector. And again, so this is only possible if you have a very intense beam, a lot of charge dumped on a dump. Now, where the positron enters in all this business? So people usually thought about this annihilation, direct annihilation, starting from a positron beam on a thick target. But we had the idea to investigate another option, that is, why don't we look at the electromagnetic shower that is a source of positron in some sense itself? Because, you know, when you have a photon or electron hitting a material, and then as in a dump, the idea is that you have all these particles that are, the energy of the incoming electron is degraded up to zero mainly, so you transform your energy of the beam in some heat, so exciting, you know, ionizing the material. So in the electromagnetic shower, you have a lot of photon radiated that produce pairs, the plus and minus, and again, they radiate, they produce pairs, and so on. So obviously you will have a huge number of positron inside the beam dump. So all the trick here again is quantitative enough the number of positron that you produce inside the dump to give you, you know, sensitivity or not. So I mean, we did calculation mainly again including the two mechanisms that should be, if you assume that the A prime Strahlung is one of the mechanisms to produce A prime, you need to assume that also the annihilation should work. I mean, it's exactly the same three-level approximation. The only problem is that quantitative is providing something more than the H-Strahlung or not. And people thought so far that it was not, I mean, not worth to look into it, while, I mean, our results show that probably it is worth it. So how can you do it in a proper way? Is that to define the so-called track length. You may imagine that inside the dump, inside the volume, you have this shower propagating, so you have a kind of fluence or a current of positron that travel within the detector that change in time both energy and their position. I mean, as a function of the position, you have the number of electrons that depends on the position and the energy. Okay, and this is all collected. If you integrate over time, now it is in some way parameterized with a single variable that tells you what's the length that a positron of a given energy may travel inside the dump. Okay. This is, I mean, a well-known thing, even from the 80s, if you look at the original EE137 paper that I guess is from the 90s, actually they have a plot with a track length. So, I mean, they knew perfectly that within the dump you may produce, I mean, a distribution of electrons and secondary particles, in particular positron. And so this is telling us how many it is that the travel. Let's check this one. This one is just the longitudinal profile of inside the dump. So you have a certain number, a higher number of, let's say, in this case, is positron with low energy, and few of them have a high energy as a function of the distance travel within the material, okay, given in radiation length of the dump. Okay, so this is a standard, you know, electromagnetic shower profile. You just integrate the number of secondary particles and you sample at different distances from the beginning of the dump, and you build an histogram like that that tells you how many positrons I have with a different energy. Same true for electrons. I mean, starting from electrons, you get this spectrum for electron and this spectrum for positron. If you start with the positron beam, you get the opposite. because obviously starting with high energy positron gets you, let you have more positron, more high energetic positron. Again, it is naive, what you naively can expect. The advantage of doing that, not in a, you know, there are analytical approximation for that. I told you it is nothing new, actually. Things are dating back to the 66, so I mean it's quite known. But the problem of the analytic approach is that obviously you can get the numbers that is more correct, in particular for the high energy, because it's closer to the first generation. As soon as you have the shower produced, and you are talking about secondaries with low energy, it is much more complicated to treat them analytically. And moreover, the problem is that there is no analytical model to really give you, you know, not only the number of positron you have, but also the distribution, the angular distribution of this positron. That can be a significant parameter in the acceptance of your detector, because we are talking about particles that gas degrading in energy, so we are expecting that they have, you know, few energy at some point, that they are going to be produced very spread, so it's very difficult that they produce something that goes inside your detector, unless you have a huge detector. So the spread is due not only to the pi production and the branched hadron, but it's also due to the fact that the electrons or positrons, when they travel in the material, they have multiple scattering. So the combination of all these effects is not analytically easy to do. While what we found is that, you know, you can assume the giant is producing reasonable results, actually, in terms of comparing even this analytic calculation to the simulations. They compare pretty well. Well, we compare two different tools, completely different. Please.
So the idea here is you're colliding two beams that are both produced by a shower? Like, is it a positron beam and another beam both produced by a shower, or are you only producing positrons by the shower?
You initiate the shower with high energy lepton beam, whatever it is, electron or positron.
But you're getting your positrons from the shower, right?
Yeah, but in principle, why? I mean, the difference is that normal stuff, usually you have an electron beam. So far, we have a high-intensity electron beam, and then you gain a positron out of the dump. But nothing prevents to use positron. Okay? If I use positron, the effect is that this curve that is now calculated for positron reverses with the electrons. So I got a spectrum. Let's say my positron that I produce inside the dump usually gets harder. Again, it's reasonable. You start with high energy, with the positron of high energy, so the chance that you have more positron with higher energies is higher than in the case that you initiate the shower with an electron.
So what exactly do you get in the setup, except from just colliding E plus and minus beams? Is it because you get more of a spread in energy? Is that what you get? Like, what's the advantage of having the setup of getting these positrons from the shower?
Because you can have the density of the electrons in material that is, you know, 10 order of magnitude higher than what you have in a positron, in an electron positron beam. You know, the intensity of the beam, let's say electron or positron, is always in the same range, 10 to the 10 particle per second. Okay, then you hit another beam that again is 10 to the 10. Roughly speaking. While in case you have a beam dump, you get, you know, 10 to the 10, 10 to the 23. Mm-hmm. So it's a 12 order of magnitude higher than that. Sorry. So it's obviously, I mean, the big advantage is that obviously people thought that, you know, having this electron, this positron produced inside the dump, they get immediately low energy and they cannot, I mean, they are not useful. But this is not the case. I mean, if you look at there is a region where the number of the positron that you produce in this way is increased. So this is just, we found that, you know, running simulation, we had two different methods, Fluca and Giant. Actually, one, this so-called track length is one of the scorers that Fluca produces. So it's kind of things that you just ask Fluca to give you the score, and it give you.
Sorry, I guess I don't fully understand the variable, but sort of, let's say I'm shooting the 20 GeV electron beam into the target.
Yes.
Do we expect to make more than one hard positron, or no, at most I'll get one? I mean, if I want to get a positron with energy above 10 GeV.
Obviously, you won't get any positron higher than the energy that you get for the single positron that you hit. But as soon as you degrade in energy, nothing prevents that your 10 GeV electron, let's say, starting with electron, 10 GeV electron spread in, you know, two 5 GeV electrons. The 5 GeV electron give you 2.5 GeV electron, and so on. So you get a lot of particles with lower energy. I mean, the energy at the end of the day needs to be conserved. The number of particles by the energy carried by each particle needs to be, the integral of that needs to be the same as the number of particles you produce in the dump by their energy, obviously. But the way how you change it, this distribution is not trivial. Because it depends on the mechanism on which you transfer energy from the primary electron or the primary. But positron, electron, and gammas are the same, very similar from the point of view of the electromagnetic shower. They shower, they just produce, you know, brechstrahlung, and brechstrahlung produce gammas, high energy gammas produce pairs, and so on. Whatever you initiate, high energy gammas, high energy positron, high energy electrons. There is a tiny difference because the first radiation length where the first things happen, obviously, if you start from a positron, it's not the same as an electron. So naively, you may expect that starting from a positron beam, in case you may have an equivalent intense positron beam, that is another story. But assuming that you in your life you can choose between the same intensity of electron or positron, okay, and you shoot them on a target. In one case. Yeah, I know, this is not very intuitive, but you can consider that a kind of distance. This is normalized to the radiation length in the material in order to have, a kind of a general curve that not depends on the material that you are hitting. You can consider, in some sense, what's the distance that you have that a single particle may travel inside the material, okay? And this tells you as a function of the energy, is a distribution. So I can tell you that there is a lot of low energy citron, okay, that travels a lot. So inside your volume, you may have a lot of positron. If you follow a single positron inside the dump, okay, it's difficult to say because positron transform in a gamma and then transform in a positron. So is not even meaningful to say what happens to a single particle. What you can do is just put a flux detector in the middle and see what's the current of particle going through. Okay, at the different distance, you are expecting to have, as far as you stay closer to the beginning, I'm expecting to have a flux of high energy particle. As soon as you get at the end of the dump, you get particle with lower energy. Okay, that is reported. That is reported in some sense here, okay? And then after that, and that is also telling how many particles you have for a given energy. And after that, then you can imagine again that each particle is not completely, one particle at one point in the dump may provide two particles in another point. So it's, the number of particles is not conserved because you have radiation, you have other stuff. So the dynamics is, maybe complicated, but the way how you extract this information is very simple. You sample, you tell Jeant to put a flux detector at the different depth in the dump, and you just look at you count how many photons, what's the energy of a positron, electrons, muons, whatever you have. Okay, it's very simple. So, and it's also very difficult to get wrong. I mean, this is so trivial practically to implement with a simulation. So I already, this is the advantage of also getting, since you have a simulation, when you sample the particles at a certain depth, you know everything about the particle, so you know where it's going. And then you can also build your differential distribution, not only in energy, but also in angle. That is useful, again, if you want to do precise estimate of the effect of all this business in a real reach. So, what's the effect then in practice? How it translated is this new mechanism? This mechanism may be useful or not for at the end of the day. So again, if we go to the visible, I just remind you how it works. So you have the dump, so you produce your shower here, and then a particle are produced, your A prime, everything is shielded. So the A prime, if decays inside here, you can't see anything. But if it needs to decay in that area, in order to have the positron, the E plus E minus pairs traveling to the detector. And this is the way how people, I told you that this is a kind of triangular shape I was mentioning before. And we just focus on E137 since this is, in some ways covering all the other ones are very, very old experiment. And you can see here that, I mean, I don't want to go into details of the experiment. I'll just tell you that this is the more sensitive, that the results are mainly based on that. And these are the results when you include also the resonant and non-resonant effect. Obviously, the region where the resonant may be effective is limited in kinematics, because by definition, the resonance needs to have positron and electron the right energy. But this is much better, I mean, as a factor of at least a 2, compared to the standard Strahlung. The non-resonance mechanism that is reported here is, you know, providing just a tiny fraction, because it goes immediately below what you are expecting from the Strahlung, given, I mean, the constraint kinematics and all the other parameters that you want to include. So it means that in this case, a specific is not, I mean, obviously not changing completely the picture, but still means that you may think to use this mechanism as a viable mechanism.
So I understand the width of the resonance annihilation, this is just coming from the positrons scanning through the energies.
So this is the point, that since you have a damp, you can imagine that a single electron is going through all possible energy states, because it needs to move from, let's say, 10 GeV up to zero. This is the trick. Well, if you have a thin target, and your electron beam shoot the thin target, obviously all your positron has the right energy to excite the resonance, or the energy that it loses in a thin target is so small that, I mean, you have to be very already tuned in the right region, if not you will never get it. While the damp has for free all possible energy, and you are sure that they are going to through all possible energy. So at some point, whatever is the mass you are talking about, the positron that gets, you know, from 10 GeV needs to go to zero, is going through.
So, and what's happening to the tip of the limit here? So it looks like...
Exactly. I mean, this is the limitation are mainly due to the energy then you want to detect on one side and the other. And here, this is what I mentioned at the beginning. This calculation was done with the correct approximation that provide, going over the Weizsäcker-Williams approximation, usually people does.
Can I ask a related question? So,
sure.
I mean, the entrance width is presumably very narrow, and the electron degradation is not a perfectly continuous process. So, I mean, it still, you know, still takes discrete steps in energy. So,
yeah, but we are talking.
Actually, sure that you get the right luminosity in terms that you really sample.
So there are obviously you, I mean, to be fully precise, you should consider that the electrons that you are eating are not at rest. I mean, they are in shells, so they have their own energy, so they have discrete states, but the width of these states is small compared to what we are talking about here. So in principle, you can consider as a kind of continuum. So it's they are not affecting the results of this calculation. So you can ignore them.
Yeah, no, I wasn't worried now about the uh-huh. distribution of electrons in the orbit, but rather about, if the entrance width is it's narrow, right?
The entrance of
narrow. There's a narrow resonance. So you must match the resonance condition.
Yes.
And so the electron energy must be precise.
Exactly.
The resonance.
Yes.
Now, I mean, you're saying I get this for free because my electrons.
Yes. All electrons is exactly pass through this value.
They might not do it perfectly continuously, so I just
why they should. I mean, the struggling the energy ionization is usually parametrized as far as you can ignore the electron that you know is not a free electron sitting there, is something moving inside the atom, but the struggling is usually treated as a continuum process. I mean, the way how an electric field in entering the material is transferring energy to the electrons is continuum. In the approximation that you ignore that the electron is tied to an atom, and then, but the scale is so different that you can demonstrate that this is not an issue for.
So if the energy loss wouldn't be perfectly continuous, then you might worry about.
Obviously, yes, absolutely, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. If you have, you know, steps in your way how your electron lose energy, yes, you are perfectly right. But the point is that the only way, I mean, why an electron should lose energy? We know he's eating the other electrons, and the electrons usually, I mean, not only in the calculation, but I mean, the picture we have in mind is that you're kind of electric field where it continuously degrades its energy, transferring energy to the electron of the material. It is the, I mean, struggling the way how ionization works. As far as you can, you know, ignore this secondary, I mean, secondary, depends on what you are looking at. For instance, for the thin target, this effect may be significant because, since I was talking that, assuming that to excite the resonance, I need to have, you know, a delta E for my positron that sits between that value and this other value. Now, if I have a thin target, obviously, I want to be sure that my energy range is exactly the one that needs to excite the resonance, but due to these molecular or atomic electrons levels, this may shift a little bit, and then I lose part of my, you know, precision, even if I have, you know, the perfect beam centered exactly in the energy of the resonance, I may have this effect. The advantage here is that you have for free every electron you may think that at some point in its life is passing through the energy of the resonance. This is the, you know, the trick.
But then, sorry, I'm not sure I understand. Why shouldn't, so this resonance annihilation shouldn't extend also to lower Ma prime masses?
I mean, because here then you have a threshold, a low masses, then you get, this is folded with the acceptance of E137. This takes into consideration the threshold they have. They have a threshold of 1 GeV. I mean, you're not, you, in these limits, I mean, people usually are not clear on that, but there is a lot of assumption. You are assuming that you know what is the efficiency of detecting E plus E minus pairs. Because if you have efficiency equal to zero, I mean, the limits are not valid. If you're, you know?
Yeah, but this, I mean, this shape that you are showing there is for E under 37. So if
exactly.
You have another experiment with lower threshold, you will have this resonant annihilation also to.
I will show you what happens in other cases. For instance, in the invisible case. But yes, depends on the. This is a convolution of many parameters. I mean, how you produce the A prime, where it can decay, so the length, the decay length, and how you detect what are the threshold in particular. And again, I want just to stress that. All this information for instance, E137 are, you know, more or less available because people, I think they're mainly died. I mean, I don't know if they are still around, only a few of them for sure. So this is just to say that it's important now to, you know, a new generation where you have everything under control, you take care of, you know, threshold, you know exactly what you are doing. So the same thing, oh, sorry.
Where are the bounds from supernovae?
Where?
Supernovae cooling bounds.
I will probably add, you know, where I put all the. Here is the. This is the limits in the visible.
I don't think it contains the stellar.
No, because the epsilon is, I mean, it's limited, you see, in the range of 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7. No, it's not as low as.
So the plotless epsilon square is the one you just showed right now?
Yes. Where is it? Epsilon square, yes, sorry. Yes. Yeah.
It's epsilon, isn't it?
No, this is epsilon, yes. This is epsilon.
Right on top of this. So epsilon is 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 5.
So sit below. No, but this is not to show that, you know, this is the best limit. This is the limit that you obtained reinterpreting data from E137, so an experiment in term of A prime.
Well, and the nice thing is the resonant effects are above 30 MeV.
Yes.
So
the piece of that could go to around 100 MeV.
But much lower epsilon.
And for instance, the other advantage is that if you apply the same trick, for instance, with lower energy, in principle, you can cover here. You get a sensitivity in the region where barium-8 anomaly was claimed. So it's a region that may be interesting. Okay, it is already with data already existing. I mean, this is not a new experiment. It's just doing things in a different way based on the same exact data set.
I mean, a lot of, as you said, a lot of these bounds on different models, people just
they get them by recasting old papers or old results where the
yes.
precise conditions are not specified, like the E137 threshold that you mentioned.
Yes.
They have three different values that they mentioned in the paper.
Exactly.
Two and three. Or something, and
actually, they have different setup, experimental setup that correspond also to different. But this is nothing. I mean, if you look at, I should have a slide. If you look at, for instance, results from LSND, it is a different business because this is decay of pions. Okay, so you every time that you have gammas, a pi zero decay into gammas or eta decay into gammas, you can play the same trick. One of the two gammas is replaced by a prime, and then you look at the decays as a source in tensors, because I mean number of particles that you produce is huge. And this is another technique used in the decay experiment. LSND that run in 94-98. The usually plots are shown, you can see here. Boundary are calculated here, okay? This was by Patrick and Iverville that originate the first limits, looking at how the experiment was done. When they published Miniboom results last year, the LSND results jumped up by an order of magnitude, because Patrick was saying that they were wrong in calculating the original flux of pions by, you know, an order of magnitude. And so the result was that if you now you look at this boundary, this limit projected in this plot, they goes up by an order of magnitude. So we have to be very, very careful in the way how these limits are plot in past experiment as a layers of interpretation, misinformation, because again, some of this information were probably not available, are not more available for them. And same thing for instance, like this experiment, this boundary will never consider that your initial, your electron, whatever you are doing, I mean, is inside the dump. Inside the dump doesn't mean that you can radiate a prime only in the first radiation length. Okay, so you have to consider that the electron gets degraded. So if you do that, you immediately get a different spectrum that again reduce by a factor of 3-4 these limits, go up by a factor 3-4.
I guess my question is that given the incompleteness of information, people keep doing these recasts and
yes, okay. And they are wrong.
For some simple models like A prime, like maybe it's okay, and
yes,
it's fine.
I totally agree.
But for other things, is there any? You basically have to redo this experiment and actually specify.
This is exactly the point. Yes, that I don't think that for. I mean, both intrinsic reasons, sometimes, like in this case, I mean, evaluation of the flux, of the initial flux can be complicated, I mean, can be not easy, then you can be off by order of magnitude. I mean, we are not talking about, you know, 10, 20% difference, we are talking about order of magnitude. Or you may simply have not casted inside the right information. Like, for instance, obviously, if you want to see plasma minus, okay? It strongly depends on your apparatus what is the threshold that you put. Because if you lower the threshold, you probably get a good chance to get also the low energy part that, again, naively, you may expect is providing the most part of the signal. So where you put the threshold is very, very, you know, important and can provide, again, order of magnitude difference in the reach. So how these details are treated, were treated in these, they are all published paper on a PRL, on PRD. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a report, internal report. These are the limits that people usually use or is used to see. And I'm saying that it makes sense because, you know, in the past, the previous generation of interpretation of this data in with the A prime was made, you know, in a very simple way, naive way, just to give the order of magnitude. The problem is that from this very, you know, rough calculation, they were given as, you know, something absolutely well done, that it is not the case. So, I mean, this is the caveat, and you're right. Probably the only way is to run new experiments and be sure that you control all these parameters, and then do an estimate that is realistic out of the experiment. Okay, Okay, so for the invisible decays, there's something similar. We consider a couple of experiments, E137 and A64, that again, you didn't get any results, and then you can reinterpret them also in the invisible sector. Or, let's say, some active beam dump experiment proposed like NA64 or LDMX for the future, and BDX as a prototype of the beam dump experiment for the future. And again, these are the, right or wrong, we started from here, but okay, assuming that they are correct, that probably they are not, but assuming that, that this is the baseline, and then we see what's the effect with respect to this one. And here is the result that, again, you gain a sensitivity, depending, again, strongly on the threshold, on how the experimental apparatus is done. You see that there is a significant difference. For instance, an A64 is not gained much by this mechanism because the threshold they have is high. An A64 is 100 GeV electron beam with a threshold of 50. So it's a missing mass, so you shoot your electron on a calorimeter, and you look at the energy that the calorimeter sees. If it is, higher, if you lose more than 50 GeV, you claim that you see something. If the energy is compatible with higher than 50, you say, I don't lose any energy. Okay, this is very, again, missing energy technique. LDMX is more fine because you actually want to look at the missing momentum. So you measure everything at the beginning, and then you see if you can spot that you have more sensitivity, better background rejection. But I mean, roughly speaking, it's the same story. BDX is the one that I showed you before. So you shoot your electron on a dump, and then you put a far detectors like neutrino oscillation, exactly the same technique, identical. But in this case, you are expecting to see dark matter signal. And E137 is exactly the same, the same logic. And you see here that again, you can gain, depending on the region, you have up to a factor of 10 in 20 to 40 MeV. Obviously, it's limited in energy. Why? Because positron, the most powerful positron that you can excite, you have a huge number of positron in only in this narrow mass range that correspond to the resonance mass. Then we play the game, for fun, and say, okay, this is, remember that we, depending if you start with a positron beam or an electron beam, you may have a different content, different energy of your secondary particles. And we say, why, assuming that tomorrow we are going to run, or we have the possibility to run the same exact experiment with the same experimental technique, the same number of positron target that you have with the electron target. What happens? And the gain is even higher. So show that in principle, if you are available, if you are allowed to, if you have a positron beam, in principle you can get something significant. And this is particularly true for an A64 that actually has a positron beam as well as an electron beam, because this is secondary, how they do is starting from proton beam, and then they, secondary beams that produce photons, photon radiate, and then you get positron and electron. Now they are selecting only electrons in their experimental setup, but I think it's very easy, and intensity of positron will be more or less the same as the electron, because being a secondary beam, you don't accelerate positron, you just take it what you get. And so I'm pretty sure that this will be interesting for them, because they can easily or they can add this the if they are able to identify positron entering in their apparatus or hitting their calorimeter, they will be able to enlarge the reach. Okay, so the conclusion it's what I say, that positron needs to be considered. This annihilation that a priori was completely disregarded, reasonably by people. Now, a careful calculation showed that there's another mechanism that needs to be included in the evaluation of all previous limits, whatever they are, correct or wrong, but this part needs to be there. And also that may open possibilities for the future, because if you have a positron beam, the reach that you is a little bit different than starting from electron beam, because the composition in the beam dump is different, and then you get high another spectrum that provide sensitivity in a different area. Thank you.
a great talk. Any more questions from Marco?
The last I heard was the Cornell proposal was vetoed, and they were not going to do it. Has anything changed recently, or is it?
No.
Okay.
No. You know, this, all these colliders or machine are. That has been dismissed like Slack, LCLS, machine. I mean, they are mainly focused on biology or chemistry. They have to deliver a beam for another community. So anything that is gonna, you know, in some way interfere with the main goal is not supported. This is, I mean, the feeling we had during these years, both Cornell, Slack. It's very difficult to, you know, it's. Maybe more political than technical, because actually they have a nice beam, and then the MAPS idea was to extract one of the positron beam that is a 60 GeV beam, so it's a very high positron beam, very high energy positron beam, and just shoot exactly as I showed you before, that, you know, simple and easy with the low cost. But the problem, I think, is more about the politics, that you don't want, you know, now the machine is doing different things, and so they have to give priority to this program, not to particle physics.
Well, let's thank Mark again.
Okay. Thank you.